What's going on, trail and ultra runners? Welcome to another episode of the Coopcast, a podcast where we explore all areas of ultra running, including training, racing, nutrition, physiology, psychology, as well as have a little bit of fun banter along the way. As always, I'm your host, Coach Jason Coop, and on this episode of the podcast, we have Jose Areta, who is a lecturer in sports nutrition and metabolism at the School of Sport and Exercise Sciences at Liverpool John Moores University. Jose's primary interest is in the area of training nutrient interactions in humans, which basically means how the foodstuffs that you eat have an effect on your body when you are actually training and racing. We had this enlightening conversation about this concept of low energy availability in athletes, and we go over this case study of an athlete that he worked with personally that was having issues with low energy availability and was able to correct those over the course of a few years with some deliberate calorie increases. We also talk about how athletes can safely manage their weight and train effectively at the same time, which is quite a hard balance to strike, if I don't say so myself, in working with a lot of athletes that are in that exact same situation. So let's get right into it. Here's my conversation with Jose Areta. What's the research field been like recently? Because I know that, you know, a lot of the universities come February or March, they completely shut down. You know, they let all the students out. They kind of hodgepodged the remainder of their classes and graduation and things like that. But it seems like the, at least I get this, I'm kind of getting this sense just from keeping track of the research that's been coming out from February until now, you know, the middle of June,
yeah,
that the backlog is starting to wind down. Like, there was this backlog of research that, you know, that was getting, you know, going through the peer review process and going through the publishing process. And it just seems like now it's just starting to wind down, and everybody that wants to produce additional research is just kind of like, yeah, we can do like meta-analyses, or we can go reanalyze old data, but it just seems like we're starting to enter that phase because the opportunity to actually perform original research, because the subject availability is so helter-skelter, it's just hard to get a pool of people. So what's your sense on it?
So the thing is that, you know, I think the lag time is going to be a lot more than just a couple of months, because it really... something that people don't really realize is that it really takes years from the moment you sort of start, you know, collecting data to the moment you actually publish that data. The funny thing is that, you know, you read a scientific article in like, I don't know, it depends how much detail you read it in, but you can read it in, let's say, half an hour, you know, maybe it's research that took like years to get to print. So, you know, the fact that we're going through this sort of research halt, you know, at the moment, and it's been known since like, what, 3 months now or so, I think we're going to start to see that maybe in a year time. It really depends on the field of work and the things. It depends what stage in your career you're at. But, you know, you have like a lot of studies in the pipeline that, you know, some of them, you got all the data, but you haven't had time to analyze it or to write that down and so on. So I think a lot of people have sort of a backlog of research that you are still going to see coming out. What you don't see is like laboratory-based studies, but we, you know, some of the studies that we are currently doing are survey-based,
yeah,
or some things that we can do remotely, like, you know, provided that, you know, some of the work that I do is with road cyclists, and we can collect a lot of data remotely as well with power meters and, you know, food logs and so on. So we can still do some things, but, you know, it's not the full on physiological adaptation type of analysis that some of us do. So maybe what you would see is maybe a shift in the work that some people are doing, but I don't think it's going to stop completely. But yeah, as you say, eventually, if this went on for like a year, you would see a lot of reviews coming out on meta-analysis and so on.
Yeah. Did you have any the research that you're involved with just have to stop? Like anything that had like an intervention and like in the middle of the intervention, you can't get the subjects back into the lab or anything like that?
Correct. Yeah. So basically, I was, I have a PhD student with which we were about to start data collection in the lab. We just couldn't start, basically. And I consider myself lucky, because if we had started, then we would have had to stop halfway through, which is worse, because you already invested resources and time and so on. So we were just about to start when all this happened. But that's the case. Like everything came, you know, shut down, basically.
Yeah. We have a consumer-facing physiology lab here. It's not utilized for research purposes or anything like that. It just now booted back up. I mean, here in the end of June, where we've started to bring athletes back in for standard, like lactate threshold, VO2 max testing and stuff like that. And it's surprisingly, the response that we've gotten from the athletes, because we can kind of outlay the protocol and the safety measures that we're using, they haven't felt, you know, unsafe at all. I mean, they felt, you know, very safe, like coming in, getting, you know, I mean, we're collecting gases and, you know, pricking, you know, taking blood pinpricks, and that's the extent of the, you know, yeah, that's the extent of the surveys or the assays that we're doing.
Yeah. Here, you know, we still haven't defined yet when we are going to go back to the lab. And we're still trying to define. When I say we, it's like the country, really. Like the, you know, from top to bottom, there has to be a very clear outline of what we can and cannot do in the lab. In terms of like what the government and, you know, Public Health England says to us that we can or cannot do. I was present at an online meeting with members of the sort of directed by the Physiological Society, which is an important society that sort of brings together, you know, physiologists from several countries around the world, and is UK based, and trying to say like, okay, what can we do and not do in the lab at the moment? And there was not really a clear outline, but, you know, it seems that the population that we work with, mainly that are like young, fit participants, the risks of them getting COVID or getting any negative consequences are extremely low. You know, this seems to be something that affects mainly elderly, you know, unfit or like with some sort of like metabolic complication. So we hope, you know, that at least that is going to give us some support to start to do research sometime soon. But we have to make sure that any sort of interventions that decrease any source of risk are put in place.
Yeah. Strange times. Yes. Strange times. I hope your research can kind of get back on track, because I've always found it fascinating over the years. I mean, any research having to do with metabolism, and particularly substrate metabolism, which you're involved in a lot, it's one of those things that in the endurance space, and it's irrespective of whether we're talking about runners, cyclists, triathletes, or in the case of our audience here, ultra runners, it's always something that gets a keen interest. And I think that interest, and you've seen this over the course of your career professionally, it seems to get ratcheted up year after year after year, because of this like polarization almost of dietary strategies and dietary manipulations that we're starting to see amongst endurance athletes specifically. So I hope that we can continue to see contributions from the research side continue to trickle in over the course of the next 3 years.
Yeah, totally. I think, you know, I think it's been quite prominent since like the early 20th century, really. Like the contribution of, you know, substrate use is such an important factor to sort of performance and, you know, how people feel really when they exercise. It was like as early as like 1920s, you know, the research of August Krog that was already showing that, you know, the use of fat or carbohydrates really had a huge effect on how people were feeling when they were exercising, and the effect of like carbohydrates for how much more efficient muscle contraction was in terms of like the use of oxygen and how much energy you generate per liter of oxygen. And I think this 100 years later, you know, people are becoming to realize how important that that is more and more. When I say people, it's not the researchers, but it's more like general population. But there, as you say, there's huge polarization and this whole idea of like low carb, high fat training, you know, is picking up in terms of like interest in by a lot of athletes, but you know, there's still a lot of research to be done to show if there's actually enhanced or impairs performance.
Yeah, it takes a while. I think that's the take-home message with a lot of that research, is that you mentioned some of the stuff starts in the 20s, and it takes a while for it to actually take root into practice, because you can never take a singular study in and of itself and draw a whole lot of conclusions or actually like practical outcomes from it. And I think you realize that because you do a lot of work with athletes individually in a coaching capacity too, correct?
Yes. So basically, you know, what is the translation of what we do in the lab to what happens in the field is some of the things that I think we do quite well at Liverpool, John Moores, and our, you know, the way that we work is basically from molecule to performance kind of thing. You know, we basically try to nail the work that we do at a sort of physiological molecular level and see how that potentially translates into performance gains. But, you know, we are aware that what we have very well controlled in a laboratory setting is not exactly what's happening in a much more like wilder environment. When we go out on the field and try to see how we can improve the performance of an athlete, that is multifactorial, really, the performance outcome.
Right. So let's start to circle back into firmly where you're one of the pieces of your wheelhouse, because I don't want to pigeonhole you into one specific piece. But one of the pieces of your wheelhouse is carbohydrate utilization, carbohydrate oxidation, and specifically low energy availability. And this has started to perk the interest of a lot of endurance athletes over the course of the last few years. And I think a big facilitator of that has been this transition from the female athlete triad to this term that's a little bit more comprehensive to essentially describe the same thing, which is REDS or Red S. But this concept of low energy availability has really become a highlight within endurance athletes, simply because it's hard to get a fix on. It's really hard to determine if an athlete is under a condition where they're operating with low energy availability, and the consequences are so can be so staggering. So why don't we first just kind of set the table in terms of what do we actually mean with low energy availability, and then start to dribble into what are the potential like negative outcomes of an athlete having to consistently train in that state?
Yep, that's I think it's fair to go back to the basics. Sometimes, you know, but for your audience, or for everyone really, I think for some researchers as well, I think for us it's always good to go back to the basics and try to, you know, think what where this is coming from and what actually low energy availability is. So to give a little bit of a historical recap, the research on low energy availability sort of started in the early 90s. And the origin of like trying to look at what energy availability was and what low energy availability represented comes from observations on the field that female athletes in particular had this condition where disorder eating and low bone mineral density and menstrual dysfunction happen together, which gave rise to the concept of the female athlete triad, as you mentioned before. It was not clear, though, why this was happening in female athletes. It was actually the stress of exercise, the fact that they were doing a lot of, physical activity, or if it was the fact that they had like a decreased energy from the diet that was actually having an effect. But you know, a series of research in the 90s and 2000s were able to sort of tease down that, you know, regardless of the stress of exercise, the amount of energy available from the diet was actually was having a negative effect on markers of bone metabolism. So, short studies run in the lab seem to identify that it's actually not the stress of exercise, but the energy that is available from the dietary energy that is available that actually has an effect. So I think it's fair. I think we can actually define what is energy availability as, as a concept, but also numerically you can define what energy availability is. So how do we come up with this number? Energy availability is the energy from the dietary intake, so in calories, let's say. From that, we subtract the energy expended during exercise, also in calories, and then we normalize it to the fat-free mass. So we say the energy availability is X amount of calories per kilo of fat-free mass per day. That's normally how we refer to it. And then you can, achieve different levels of energy availability. So this energy, why it's called energy availability? Because it's like energy available for metabolic processes. So it's the energy that your body has available after you'd use during exercise to maintain your normal physiology. So a value of about 45 kilocalories per kilo of fat-free mass per day, approximately, is what's going to sort of maintain your body weight through time in a normal state and maintain your normal physiological function. Yeah, so you would expect that someone that is in a sort of healthy state would see around 40 to 45 kilocalories per kilo of lean body mass per day. So if you drop under that, then it's when you begin to see like the consequences of low energy availability, which initially, in a person that is in a normal state, which will drop weight, right? But that doesn't mean that if you are in low energy availability, you're always gonna drop weight. And this is an area that needs to see some distinctions in terms of if you stay for a long period of time in low energy availability, it might be that you stop dropping weight because you undergo what is called like metabolic adaptation. Yeah, so there is a series of endocrine, sort of your hormones adapt to this new state or respond to this new state. And then you do this then prolonged over time, so these early endocrine or hormonal responses, then this will result in sort of physiological dysregulations.
And I think what a lot of athletes don't realize is the sheer amount of calories that represents. We threw out this number that I don't want to kind of gloss over, and we might have to get the calculators out to make these numbers real for a person listening.
Yeah.
That you have that in order to avoid low energy availability, you need about 45 kilocalories per kilogram of fat-free mass. Yeah. And fat-free mass being different than total body mass. But if you just do the quick calculations on somebody who is 60 kilograms, and let's just say they have a body fat a percentage of 20%. So that's going to give you, I'm doing the math right here, that's going to give you a fat-free mass of 48 kilograms, and you multiply that by 45 kcals per kilogram, that's automatically 2,100 calories right there. And that's a pretty small person.
Yeah.
And what a lot of athletes, when I've presented this to athletes, the first thing that they're going to say is like, that's a lot of calories right there just to sustain normal metabolic function at that point.
Yeah.
And yeah, the sheer quantity of calories, I think, is one of the things that athletes look at. And when you translate that to their actual diet, what they actually need to eat day to day, that's when it becomes something from the athlete's point of view that becomes hard to like wrap their head around that they actually need to eat that much.
Yes. Yeah, no, I completely agree with you. I think this is something. Well, first that we luckily we don't have people going with a calculator next to what they eat doing it all the time, because there's a degree of disordered eating or eating disorders that we don't want to inflict in people. So that's one thing. The other thing is that a lot of these values come from laboratory based studies. Yeah, some of which, you know, or the majority of which use liquid diet. So we have to be very, very careful in like how we extrapolate some of these values to like the real world. Yeah.
Yep.
So you might have heard, and probably a lot of people is aware of these thresholds that we have for energy availability. So some people say like, oh, if you are like, you know, under 30 kilocalories per kilo of fat-free mass, then that's low energy availability. And yes, there is support in the literature saying that, okay, when you drop under this energy availability value, then you see markers of bone metabolism, for example, being affected. You know, these are studies that lasted for like 5 days in like people who were previously sedentary, and they are put to exercise, you know, for 5 days every day at a continuous level of low energy availability. So yeah, I think fair enough. In that study, that value has this effect. But then we have to be a bit careful of what we extrapolate to what's happening in athletes on the field. So it might be that, you know, on with a, you know, with a different diet in a specific circumstances, like you might not actually need 45 kilocalories per kilo of fat-free mass, and it also we have to see what other physical activity you are doing outside the formal exercise. So it's hard to come up with an exact number. As much as we want to make you know, nutrition an exact science, and I do my best on the everyday work that I do to try to make it as precise as possible, we are aware also that you know, life can be a lot more complicated than just a few numbers, because what we can quantify, it's quite small versus what we cannot really quantify.
Yeah, and many times athletes can actually perform for periods of time, sometimes short periods of time, sometimes long periods of time, with this chronic low energy availability state going on. But yes, what we found is that when we go through sometimes what are dramatic steps to restore that energy availability, and sometimes that takes many months and maybe even up to 18 months or maybe even 2 years, we can still see improvements in performance. And you just happened to author a really interesting case study that went out. And I believe this is one of the athletes that you're working with, correct?
Yes, we've been working with this athlete for quite a few years now. So I'm going to give you a bit of overview of the study, and then we can talk about also what things we expect to see when, you know, when someone is under sort of low energy availability. So when we started working with these athletes a while ago, I was not really aware of what these I knew a little bit about the female athlete triads, and I knew a little bit. It was quite new to this whole field. But you know, I started working with her, and we saw that there was no, she didn't have like her menstrual function was not really what you expect to see in a female normal. Female sedentary eumenorrheic female that has like her regular menstrual cycle. And we didn't have any other concerns in terms of like how she was feeling or how she was performing, because early on we realized that her numbers could have led to like her being a really, really good athlete. So we started working together towards like, okay, let's try to make you the best athlete you can be.
Good athlete, cyclist, correct? Like national level,
yes,
type cyclist.
Sorry. Yeah. Yes. But back in the day, I mean, she progressed from being like a club level athlete to like a solid national level athlete. So this is one of Australia's top time trialists, and I cannot really say much more, just to, you know, keep make sure that, you know, her identity remains anonymous. Yes, very good athlete. Basically, we started recording. Okay, let's keep track of your menses. Let's start recording your body weight, and you know, all her training is recorded on Training Peaks, because we have all the power meter data and so on. So at the start, it was more me being you know, concern about tracking some sort of basic body, how do you say, like anthropometric parameters, yep. Basically body weight and training and, you know, physiological status from her menses, you know. And it was like, sometimes it's hard when you're working with athletes, female athletes, at least maybe being a male coach, because you don't really, you feel like it's a bit invasive to ask about, you know, their menstrual cycle and so on. Maybe this is just male putter, because we're not used to asking these things to females. I think sometimes depends on what athlete you're dealing with, but for some people it's easier to disclose this information. Anyway, I was careful of like not, you know, not pushing too much, but I think we have to sort of normalize this sort of conversation with athletes and saying like, hey, do you have a normal menstrual cycle? Like, yes and no. And let's just have like an honest, direct conversation about it.
So you had this athlete, you started working with this athlete, and you're simply trying to record power meter data, weight, performance types of data, body fat, yes, percentage. At the time, did you know that she was amenorrheic?
Yes. At one point, there was, I can't remember when this conversation came up, and I was like, do you have a normal menstrual cycle? And she goes like, well, actually, not. And I was like, oh, this is interesting. And this is like, okay, let's, and I said like, oh, have you had this conversation with your medical doctor? And she goes like, yes, and we had like some screening, but they couldn't, you know, they said like everything was fine, like my hormonal profile was fine. And I was like, okay, let's keep an eye on it, and let's keep tracking it and see what happens. And I basically was seeing some seasonal fluctuations on body weight that I thought they were normal, and sometimes there were, you know, fluctuations of a couple of kilos. And I went like, okay, it seems that, you know, the body weight kind of goes up, but then this menstrual cycle doesn't really go back to normal. And this is over a period of a few years, up until one point that there was a change in the athlete's lifestyle for a series of reasons, that we saw a quite, you know, sudden increase in body weight over a period of a few months, that it tied in with like a couple of life events, as I was saying before, for the athlete. And over this period of these few years, her menstrual cycle kind of resumed, but it was what we call oligomenorrheic. So it's like not a regular menses. So menses are supposed to be between, you know, 20 few days and 30 something days. You know, this is what is called, like, okay, this is if an athlete like has like a somewhat regular menstrual cycle, you can say like they are a human erect. You know, if it's like 26 to 35 days approximately, then, but you know what we saw is like sometimes it was like 2 months without, and then you had like a little bit of menstrual bleeding and so on. But, you know, after this episode of a sudden increase in body weight of about 5 kilos, about like 10% of increase in body weight of the athletes, a few months later, there was this, you know, the athlete reported this like heavier bleeding. And which was kind of surprising. It's just like, well, this, you know, this bleeding like knocked me off like this day, like it started and it was like quite intense. And it was just a report from the athlete. And after that, the period became regular, like very, very regular actually. And for me, that was what was really, really surprising. I was like, wow, this is like, the fact that also there was such a delay between, you know, the actual increase in body weight and the actual resumption of regular menses. For me, there was like, wow, like, has anyone like reported that before? Because, and this athlete, I must say that throughout this period, she kept training really hard.
Right, right.
Yeah. So there was no withdrawal of like training. If anything, she had actually trained more. Yeah. And this is basically what we're seeing in the field, is sort of supporting the idea that is what was being shown in these sort of shorter lab-based studies, that you know, it's not really the stress of exercise or the energy drain from exercise, but the balance between you know, the amount of energy intake and the energy expenditure, really. So here I must say that, you know, yes, this study has methodological limitations, obviously, because, as I said before, you know, when you're on the field, things are a lot harder to control. We are not running a study, right? It's like basically we're making observations. We're trying to systematically collect data and do observations based on that. There's no assessment of energy availability. So really, we don't have an idea of what the actual energy availability was. But provided that there was an increase in body weight and we had an also assessment of body composition through DEXA, it's undeniable that it's been a period of like increased energy availability or surplus energy availability. Yeah.
In that body weight increase, I don't want to gloss over that either. That's rather dramatic, especially for an athlete of that caliber to go through that much of a body weight gain, irrespective of the time frame.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not like just daily fluctuation of a pound or two. I mean, you're talking 10%.
Yes. So for this particular athlete, it translated about like 5 kilos.
Yeah.
For an athlete this size, you can say, well, that's quite a lot.
Yeah.
The important thing here is that, you know, I think we have to move the focus from body weight to performance when you're working with a performance athlete. I think a lot of people would feel, or most athletes would feel, rather depressed if they were like focused on their body weight and saw an increase, because they would equate that with probably like a lack being leading to a lesser perfect status. You know, there's this idea of like less body weight equates perfection, and that, I think that's why a lot of people are like chasing like lower body weight. I think, you know, the focus has to be moved away from that to what's actually the actual performance of the athlete.
And after I just want to break in really quick, because I want to make this point clear. Even after the body weight gain and regaining her regular menses, she still could perform, based on all the performance and testing and power meter data that you had, at the same level.
Yes.
So, certainly not worse.
Yes. So here we have to make, you know, I don't want to advocate for low body weight by any means. The thing is that we need proper data to be able to support this. I think like low body weight, very low body weight, it's not really sustainable through prolonged period of time. So for this, what we do with these athletes, we look at their what's called like mean maximal power. So how much power they can generate. This is mechanical power they can generate on their power meter through on specific time durations. Yeah, we can report this on absolute values or relative to their body weight. Yeah, so these two values are important for cycling performance. So the relative power output is very important for going up a mountain quick. And the absolute power is going to propel you on the flat surfaces quicker.
Yep.
Yeah. So what we see is that when she was the lightest, her 5-minute mean maximal power, which is sort of, you can relate that to VO2 max, really, right, to the VO2 max value, was the highest. Yeah. So you would expect that, you know, if it was to climb a mountain, maybe she could have climbed it like the quickest for that period of time. By no means I'm advocating that someone has to be in low body weight for a long period of time. What we saw though, that you know, is that when she put on body weight, like the majority of the parameters relative to the body weight remained about the same, and the absolute power output seemed to consistently keep going up,
right,
throughout this period. So what I think is most important for me is that, and I mean, this we cannot say there's causation here. We cannot say that because she put on body weight, then she can't perform better. Yeah, what I think is important is that, at least from working as a coach, you know, for an athlete, you can say like, oh, this athlete is feeling a lot better. You know, is training a lot, is feeling good. And then we can begin to think about, you know, what are all the physiological parameters that are related to, you know, having lower or higher energy availability. So from things that we know are maybe less scientific, if you want to call them something, in relation to observations that I had as a coach, was that, you know, the athlete was feeling a lot better. Whether that is because there have been changes in this athlete's life, and you know they could feel better for their training, or it's because of the energy availability itself. Right. I really don't know. And her performance on, you know, cycling is can be a bit of a funny animal in terms of performance, because it's not a lot of the things depend on dynamics of races, on how you place yourself in the peloton. It's not let's call as pure, if you want to call it something, as
it's like a 10K running race or something like that.
Yes, yeah. Exactly. Yeah. Maybe, you know, the only thing that you can equate these sort of 10K running races is to like a time trial on cycling. Yeah. You know, this is like a bit more objective, but cycling is very, very stochastic, and a lot of things come down to positioning in the peloton and so on. But you know, road cycling wise, her performance was the best during this period. Like her performances had been like very, very solid. So I think, again, having like a holistic approach, let's say, to her training, I think it's important to keep in mind that sort of keeping a healthy balance in terms of, you know, how you relate to food and how, you know, how you deal with your body weight and with your training. I think what is important is not to focus on body weight solely. And I think that's an error that a lot of athletes fall into when they go like, oh yeah, this parameter is important for performance. And we know it's important for performance. But I think it's easy for it to take over in a coach and athlete's psyche as is the area of focus for performance.
Well, I can tell you, over the last 2 decades, having worked with you know, high level endurance athletes of all different sports, that mindset of being overly focused on body weight is starting to change. It is starting to become more of a multifactorial or holistic mindset around performance, because we know performance is, you know, it's always a multifactorial thing. You can never pin it down to VO2 max or 5 minute, you know, maximal steady state power or body weight or any one metric. There's always, you know, 20 or 30 or 40 different metrics that are going into ultimately what determines performance. One of the things I want to kind of encapsulate this whole experience really, really quickly here, because I think it's a fascinating one. But one of the things that struck me the most with this case study was the time frame, because it's a long period of time that you're studying just one athlete that you have good data on the entire time. And just to paint the picture for the listeners out there, this athlete that you're working with for several years, for 3 years, she had no menstrual cycle at all that you're working with her.
Yeah, yeah.
She gained the weight. She gained 10% of her body mass, which is, once again, that's not trivial. That's significant. But then for a period of time, and this is what I'm a little bit unclear on right now, for a period of time, she had irregular menses.
Yeah.
And then... Yes,
ever since then, since she resumed her normal menstrual cycle, for the period reported on the actual paper, and then she maintained a regular menstrual cycle.
What was the period of irregularity, though? The irregular menses? Like, how long was that?
The period of irregular menses was about 3 years, up until it resumed, like, being regular in this, what I call, like, what it came up as sort of a heavier bleeding.
Yeah.
You know, that was based on the report of the athlete. Couple of months after this weight gain, what I call a weight gain episode. Yeah.
So the picture that I'm trying to paint is 3 years of no menses, weight gain, which we could correlate with an increase in calorie intake relative to calorie output. Irregular menses for another three years.
No.
Oh, okay. So set the time frame for me again, because I'm a little confused on it.
I think if I open up, because I don't remember all these numbers on top of my head.
Yeah, I'm testing your memory too. My memory gets tested a lot, so I don't feel too bad for you.
So basically, when I started working with the athlete, this athlete already had like what was amenorrheic.
Right.
Yeah, the body weight was low. Then for a period of about 3 years, there was the sort of the menstrual cycle resumed, but it was irregular.
Got
so it went from amenorrheic to oligomenorrheic. So
for 3 years, it was irregular. Yeah. That's what I wanted to get across.
Yes. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. And then after this sort of weight gain episode, this is when like regularity resumed.
Got
after a period of a few months. Yeah.
Got it.
It's not normally what you would see. It's not like a light switch that goes on and off. So for me, that was what it was impressive from, you know, working with her. I was like, wow, this is like the fact that it came back so strong and so regular. For me, that was quite impressive.
Yeah.
I think, you know, also, you know, seeing like small fluctuations in body weight and, you know, then not seeing a difference in resumption of menses is important. And also the other thing that we don't know whether you need to put on, back so many calories before you see a resumption of normal menses. I know there's ongoing research at the moment where, you know, they're trying to see if a different type of intervention of increasing like carbohydrate availability and so on in a more sort of nuanced way can actually produce a resumption of menses in female athletes. So there's excellent work done by Mary Jane de Souza in Penn State University in the U.S., and her work in this regards is absolutely brilliant, and I think we will soon be seeing from her work on that. And I know around Europe, there's interest in this work as well, and seeing like whether, you know, basically you can refuel an athlete or how much you need to refuel a female athlete to see resumption of regular menstrual cycle. The thing is that, you know, between having no menstrual cycle and having a fully functional reproductive system, there's a lot of things in between as well. So you can have a menstrual bleeding, but still have like a what we call like an ovulatory menstrual bleeding. So basically, you have no ovulation. So you can you still have a bleeding, but it's not you're not like female, yeah. Still not fertile. Or like under the hood, let's say the hormonal profile of this sort of this continuum is quite different. And this is something that I wanted to say before, is what's the actual effect of low energy availability. Yeah. So energy availability or low energy availability, whatever that is, whatever we decide to say it is in terms of thresholds or values or so on, what actually triggers or what the, let's say, what the short-term experimental studies in the lab, what they show is that it's basically a huge stressor in terms of what it does to your endocrine system, you know? So you can see... not your endocrine system, but your sort of your hormonal profile. Yeah. Most of the research has been done on females, but we see, you know, a decrease, for example, in leptin, and so people get more hungry. Leptin has a central effect on your central nervous system that seems to trigger a cascade of other downregulations. So you see, you know, luteinizing hormone, which is an important hormone for the reproductive axis, both in males and females. The frequency of the pulse is affected. You have an effect on thyroid function as well. You know, the hormone T3, which is like a master regulator of the rate of metabolic or the energy expenditure. Like this is a very important hormone, like gets down-regulated, you know, it's like consistently in the studies in low energy availability. There's a decrease in insulin, you know, bone metabolism gets affected, and that's why people tend to get like weaker bones that are in chronic low energy availability. We've also shown like skeletal muscle protein synthesis is reduced. And there's probably a lot of other effects that we don't really know, but you know the effects are quite wide.
Well, it's wide is the best way to put it, right? I mean, you just went through this whole thing, all these hormones, your bones, things like that. Menstrual cycle gets, you know, becomes irregular or non-existent, and I think the summary of it is everything is foobarred, to put it colloquially. When you go through these chronic periods of low energy availability, it's such a wrecker on all of these physiological systems. And like the confounding thing that I see as a coach, though, is that even though we can see all of these things in a laboratory setting, and we know they're deleterious. We know, absolutely know, that those things are deleterious to the athlete's performance. The athlete can still do it. Like there are some athletes out there that can still perform at Olympic level caliber while operating underneath this state. And I think that that's from an elite athlete perspective. And there are very few people that are listening to this that are the most elite of the elite. Most of the normal blokes, with all due respect, that are listening to this podcast, are in a little bit of a different situation. But I think this like conundrum of seeing the most elite of the elite win medals and win races and things like that, and having the practitioners that are working with them, the coaches and the nutritionists and things like that, know that they're in this chronic state of low energy availability, just presents this weird conundrum to present to a normal person.
Yeah. So, you know, I think it's important to consider like different, you know, what the evidence shows and what sort of theoretical models we have to interpret this. So you mentioned the triads before. We have this which is a model to try to explain, you know, what we're observing with in people and athletes. We have the red S as well, which is the relative energy deficiency in sport syndrome, which is originally sort of ties in with the triad, but it's trying to expand this idea towards the use on males as well. So there's a new also like male athlete triad, and that is extends the female athlete triad to males. So these are like models to explain what might potentially happen as a combination of observations on the field to athletes that we think they might have been exposed to chronic low energy availability. Yeah, and as you say, like, well, there are some people that are performing at their highest level, even they are, you know, they've been at in low energy availability,
yeah,
or it seems, because, well, first we have to acknowledge that we don't know, we assume, because a lot of these things are, you know, a lot of, we have like indirect markers of, well, that, yeah, that's actually is the case. That's important to note.
Yeah.
First, well, again, I don't advocate to for prolonged periods of low energy availability, but we don't really know exactly what the performance effects per se of low energy availability are. Yeah, so we know that it is likely to weaken bones. Yeah, for example, in a long term, or affects like reproductive function and so on. But the effect on skeletal muscle, besides like decreasing myofibrillar protein synthesis, we don't really know what it is.
Yeah.
And you know, in some aspects, it might have a positive effect. And by no means I'm saying that, well, we have to, you know, oh yeah, no, low energy availability is a good thing or anything like that.
Yeah.
But, you know, we have to be a bit nuanced. Also, because we have to acknowledge that weight management is part of the sport.
Yeah.
So if we cannot, I think, it shouldn't be a focused, but it shouldn't be ignored.
Yeah, let's try to drill into that a little bit deeper, because a lot of the day to day normal ultra runner athletes is always an oxymoronic statement, but the average ultra running athlete out there is, they are going to try to strike a balance between losing a little bit of weight to optimize their performance and still day to day make sure that they're covering all of their training bases. And I want to explore this in two different areas. The first one is the weight loss side of things, and try to come up with like a practical framework that athletes can use. And the second one is this kind of some of these more advanced interventions that athletes are starting to use to upregulate fat oxidation. So training with low carbohydrate availability, whether it's a back-to-back day or an overnight fast, or even during the training session, hitting a critically low point with their carbohydrate availability, which could seem in opposition to all this dialogue that we just had, that is low energy availability is deleterious, because anytime you're training with low carbohydrate availability, you could be in this area of low energy availability as well. So I want to explore both of those in more of a practical perspective, because
sure,
it is a balancing act, right? We do have to manage weight and performance and training kind of all at the same time, and they all can have different substrate goals, for lack of a better word, depending upon what the goal of the session or what the goal of the athlete is. So for the athletes that are out there, or normal ultra runners that are trying to finish their first 100 miler, or they're trying to finish, you know, 100 miler within 24 hours or something like that, and they know they want to reduce their body weight, not by a dramatic amount, but by a moderate amount, let's say like 5 pounds, 5% or something like that, like something that's not 40 pounds.
Yeah.
What are the practical things that they can go through to achieve a body weight loss that's in that range, that at the same time will strike the balance to where they can keep their day-to-day running up and they're not running into any of these deleterious effects with bone mineral density or anything else that we've mentioned?
Yeah. Cool. So I think we can agree in sort of some practical advice. Whether you know some of these practical advice is gonna what degree of, let's say, hormonal or bone marker dysregulation is gonna have. I don't have an answer for that. We can have some approaches with which you can potentially try to manage weight a bit better, but to what degree you are gonna see a negative effect or not? I don't really have the support or the
evidence. It's hard. It's hard to generalize it.
Yeah. One thing that I think is important, or two things that I think is very important to start with, is like having this idea of like a perpetual low body weight, and striving for perpetual low body weight is not a good idea.
Right.
So that's what I would start with. That's the one thing,
Perpetual being like months, like you're always at your race, quote unquote race weight for 3, 4, 5, 6 months.
Yeah, maybe sort of short periods of time. And I think there's going to be huge variation between athletes. I think we have to be aware, that it seems that females are more likely to experience stress fractures than males are. So they might be, and some of the evidence supports the idea that males are more resilient to this like low energy availability or energy deficit than females are. So with females, you have this red flag, which is the lack of or loss of a menstrual cycle that you don't have with men. It doesn't happen always, and it doesn't happen at it's not that you will have to see a loss of a menstrual cycle, but this is important to keep in mind. So you basically gotta keep your eyes open for red flags, and that is a big red flag if someone doesn't have a menstrual cycle. So that is to start thinking of what is a good idea to do and what is not a good idea. So chronic low body weight is not a good idea.
You're ruling that out. Chronic low body weight, that's the thing to avoid. We can start there.
Yes. I think that's the first thing. The second thing is really try to consider where in your performance objectives, if that's gonna give you the edge that you actually need in terms of how you balance that out between how hard you can train and the performance benefit that you're gonna get.
And I'm glad that you mentioned that, because a lot of times when athletes are looking at weight loss, they're looking at it as independent of the actual performance. And if you have as coaches, we can go through these mathematical calculations in a fairly, rudimentary and simplistic fashion and say, okay, if we have an athlete that if they want to lose, X percent of their body weight, that's going to be worth 2, 3, 4% of their performance. If they can still physiologically gain aspects of their performance that supersede that weight loss, I don't even look at it, to be honest with you. I'm like, listen, let's just train. Let's just train, maintain, because you've got more to gain just from the training than you do the weight loss. And if you end up losing a little bit of weight just because of the training, because the training is so hard, sometimes that's hard to keep up with in and of itself, then that I would always rather take the physiological improvement or the physiological-based performance improvements over the weight loss-based performance improvements, because the weight loss-based performance improvements have such a trickier balance because of the negative aspects.
Yeah, and I think it's a stressor on its own.
100%.
Try to inflict this energy deficit. So I think it's a. You can consider it a stressor overlaid to the stress of the actual training.
Yep.
Yeah. So if you think it that way, then you begin to be a bit more careful about like where you put it in terms of Even though, you know, as we were saying before, energy availability has an independent effect, or which has been shown to be independent of the actual effect of training. You know, the fact that you have to inflict some degree of energy deficit on someone can be a stressor on its own. So, you know, I think, you know, having said these two things as first steps and trying to think about, you know, whether weight management is an idea or not, as a third point, maybe you can say, okay, let's see whether if it's something that would work, if it is realistic for your body weight or body composition. One of the things, you know, cyclists have this thing, is just like, how many bicycles is the amount of bicycles that you should have? You know, they have a cyclist lab having cycling, and it's like N plus one. Right. Whatever amount of bikes you have, that's shoes. How many bicycles.
Shoes for trail runners, for sure.
Okay. And if you ask them, you know, what's your ideal body weight, it's like, oh, probably a couple of kilos less.
Yeah, exactly.
What it is now, no matter what your body weight is. So people get so fixated on what their body weight. Anyway, so it's how, you really got to consider whether it's realistic for you to drop, you know, how many kilos you wanna drop. And I think this is one of the things that you just basically gotta, you know, do a bit of trial and error, and being having a really sort of balanced approach. And I think the key word here is balanced, and I think that's one of the things that most people forget about, and they just want like black or white, you know. Oh, can I drop like 5 kilos? And just like, oh, you can maybe drop a few kilos, but from what, you know? It's just like, right. It's very easy to drop like 3-4 kilos like in a few days, but you're just gonna lose all your muscle glycogen, and that's it. You're just losing water. So where is this weight coming from? You know, if you go to the start line with low muscle glycogen, you're not gonna have the best performance. It doesn't matter how low intensity is your ultra marathon. You're still gonna need that muscle glycogen to perform well.
Yeah.
So you gotta be very, very careful on like whether, you know, you really focus on your body weight. So having said all these things, I think we can think of trying to basically withdraw a few calories per day and periodize your carbohydrate availability around the intensity and duration of your sessions. Yeah, I think the low intensity, long sessions, you're probably going to be fine with completing them with, you know, little to no carbohydrates, because it's easy to fuel them with whatever fat you have, capacity of burning fat you have. Whereas when you're going to do your intervals, you got to ensure that you're going to have a high carbohydrate availability for those sessions.
Yep.
So by doing so, you can ensure that, you know, you can slot in and complete the high quality sessions, which are key even for someone who does like a lot of mileage or is aiming to do like a race that lasts for hours. I'm sure that if you coach people, you would have like, it depends on the time of the year and so on, but you have like 2 or 3 interval sessions per week for sure. And for these sessions, you want to make sure that you have high carbohydrate availability. Basically, what you want to achieve is a period of, you know, maybe a couple of months or a few weeks where you withdraw a little bit of energy and track, you know, changes in body weight without being like overly obsessed, you know, you have to be very careful if it's an athlete that is prone to be like, you know, too focused on their body weight, and that sort of triggers some sort of eating behavior or disorder eating. So I think it requires a lot of tact. I don't think there's a magic sort of, you know, approach to it that is like, oh, you just follow this recipe and it's fine. I think The other thing that we know is that it's very, very hard to, you know, it's easy to drop weight, but it's very hard to keep it off.
Yeah.
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 The thing is, like, we as a species, and I think mammal species in general, are equipped with this drive, you know, to bounce back to whatever state we have. So you can drop weight for a little while, but eventually you're going to get hungry. You know, your metabolism is going to respond in such a way that you're going to use less energy throughout the day, and you're going to get hungry and you're going to eat more.
Yeah.
So keep that in mind. You're just, I think the healthy approach, if any, is like maybe drop some weight, if needed be, for your performance, for the key races, and then maybe go back to something that you feel is more sustainable over the long term.
I love the way that you presented the N-1 proposition, because we see that a lot, particularly in elite athletes, but it trickles down to the everyday athletes as well. Normally when I'm working with an athlete, and let's like get rid of all the caveats, right, that we mentioned earlier, and we decide that, listen, okay, let's try to get your body weight down to whatever number it is. Let's just say it's 160 pounds. I'll then go back and say, let's just get to 165 and leave the last 5 pounds on the table. It's not material to your performance in this long endurance event, and I don't want to roll the dice on trying to balance this, you know, razor thin edge of having the lowest body weight possible and at the same time trying to train at the high level. So let's just leave that off the table. Let's leave the last 5 pounds off the table, the last 3% off the table, kind of whatever that ends up being. And then I take almost like a two-phased approach. I use a lot of block style training. So we'll have months of very intensified training where the training intensity is very high, and then months where the training intensity is very low. So normally what I'll try to do is try to pair up the most weight loss or the biggest calorie deficit. And they're not big calorie deficits. Not to say that they're, you know, big every day, but I try to pair the most weight loss up with the lowest intensity, and the periods where they have high intensity, don't even try to lose any weight at all, because the work is more important than the weight loss. And so it ends up being this periodized nutrition approach that also correlates with the periodized kind of weight loss approach. But the way I get at it is, I just leave the last usually like 5% on the table with an athlete and don't even worry about it, because it's just too, like, all the measurement errors and like trying to get like all of those things like exactly right. Like there might be like 30 athletes on the planet across all endurance sports where that's material to the outcome of the event that they're training for. So, and I'm not working with any of those 30 athletes. Everybody else, just leave it on the table. Like, you just like, and worry about other things. Just train and get better, and don't, you know, obsess about, you know, last little part.
I must say that, you know, as much as I try to dodge your questions with my best knowledge and experience, I think it's an extremely tricky sort of topic to deal with, and that's why it's very hard to give like sort of blanket recommendations. I think it really requires a very balanced approach. As you were saying, there's really priorities in the sort of the training. That, you know, this is not really a top priority. It is important, don't get me wrong, it is important at one point for the higher level athletes, but I think the focus shouldn't really be there. And I think that's why it's important to understand what the negative effects of it are.
Yeah, 100%. And there can be big negative ones, as we talked about earlier. Let's pivot a little bit to these some of these low carbohydrate availability strategies, which I've always viewed as kind of like oxymoronic that we actually try to chase these down, because we spend so much time making sure that we have adequate fuel resources for the work required. We want to make sure that the work is maximized, the workload is maximized, the power output is maximized, the pace is maximized, and things like that, especially for the high intensity sessions. Yet we've got this kind of divergent approach where we can say, well, listen, if we're compromising our fuel availability in certain areas, we can amplify the training response that is a result of the training session itself. And I've talked about this on a few previous podcasts, and what I would do, rather than kind of like rehash all of those here, direct the listeners back to those previous podcasts where we talked about some of the low carbohydrate availability strategies that endurance athletes can use. But since I've got you on the horn with us today, Jose, what I want to talk more about is just the metabolic reality of trying to undertake any of those, and how low is too low, and trying, since you also split the field as a practitioner that actually works with athletes, how can they try to find that balance of utilizing some of these low fuel availability sessions to upregulate their fat metabolism, and at the same time not run afoul of compromising the training, either the training intensity that they can achieve or running into like an injury situation because of chronic low availability or overstress?
Yeah. So I think it's important to differentiate on nutrition for performance from nutrition for adaptation. So I think the aim of training is to generate a level of stress that eventually is going to make you better for when you really have to perform. And I think, with that in mind, then you decide when to put the fuel that you need for whatever aim you have. So for racing, you want to make sure that you have the highest amount of carbohydrate available as you can, because we know that performance-wise, this is what is going to lead to better performance, even for an ultra-endurance runner. In general, there's a clear relationship between carbohydrate intake and the capacity to perform over long distances. That's one thing. And the other thing, in terms of how can you actually sort of withdraw the use of carbohydrates in your training, there's a whole lot of different strategies in which you can do this. It can range from training fasted in the morning, for example, where you can do like a low intensity session for like as many hours as you can maintain. Basically, it's gonna require some training for you to be able to maintain your intensity of training fasted, but eventually your body is gonna adapt to train fasted. You can also train, for example, twice a day. So you do one hard session first in the morning, and then you withdraw, the ingestion of carbohydrates, and you have another session in the afternoon of lower intensity. The other option is what we call like sleeping low. So basically you have a hard session in the evening, and then you have little carbohydrates, which doesn't mean you have none, but you can have some. When I say none, yeah, or some, it's like 1 gram per kilo of body weight after. So you still have some, but importantly, you put in some protein because it's gonna aid sort of the recovery process. And then you train again in the morning, a low intensity session, or would you throw some higher intensity sort of accelerations or like little intervals or so on? So there's all different strategies that you can use. As long as you can hit sort of around the intensities that you were aiming for that session. And again, this is a balancing act, right? What you consider as important, if it's your weekly volume or if it's your whatever marker of training stress you use, if you use like a training stress score or whatever you use, you just gotta balance that out. where you draw the line, it depends on the athlete and the coach. What it seems, though, is that for when you train with low carbohydrate availability, you get the same or higher adaptation with less training. Yeah, so you make your training a bit more efficient, let's say. And what here I'm talking, you know, purely from a muscle-centric perspective. Right. The other thing that you have to consider as well is that when you train, you're not just training your muscles. And I think we have to bring the brain into the picture as well. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, physiology is, or the physiology that we do, because we focus on tissues and so on, we have a very sort of brainless model of training. And I think, you know, if you can bring in mind that the fact that you're training with low carbohydrate availability, and that's going to make the training harder, it feels harder.
Right.
Whether you are able to, if that has an effect on people being able to withstand more pain when they actually have to perform, well, really, I don't know. Yeah. But it might be an effect that actually has a positive effect, because you're training your mind as well to cope with that. Honestly, and here I'm you know, what I'm saying is a bit beyond what we have as evidence in this whole idea of training with low muscle glycogen. But for me, it's undeniable in terms of like something that we should consider when considering these strategies.
And I think it's also important to like couch these strategies, because we are, let's face it, we're talking about endurance athletes. And if a pinch is something, a pinch of something is good, a pound of it is better in the athlete's mind. That the strategies that we're talking about, as the name implies, are low carbohydrate availability strategies, not no carbohydrate availability strategies.
Correct. Yeah.
And that's an important part, because when you get to the no part, that's where that teeter-totter starts to get out of balance.
Yes. Sometimes I have to remind myself that I'm, you know, talking to a late audience, and sometimes we fall like, as you know, scientists, researchers, and so on, talking a bit abstract ways, and sometimes it's hard to explain what is low, what is no carbohydrate, and so on. But some carbohydrate is not the same as none. And as we might recommend some of these, we also, I mean, I recommend in many cases a very sort of contrasting approach to how you would have carbohydrates in your training. Some sessions are without, and some sessions are with a lot. You know,
right,
of carbohydrates. So it's not that I'm advocating for a concept. So what you try to improve is like this idea of like metabolic flexibility. You know, that you can switch in the use of fuels as necessary for your training and performance. So basically, one of the things that you have to consider as well is that if you're going to have a hard, long session, you have to train to be able to eat what you train. And also you have to train your gut to be able to, digest those carbohydrates that you are probably going to have during your race. I think a lot of runners and a lot of athletes in general don't train their eating. Some of the work that I've done with some athletes is try to train them to be able to eat more, not less.
Yep.
Because if you're going to have someone on a sort of an event that which performance lasts for like 8 hours, 9 hours, or whatever, then you want to make sure that they are able to have the carbohydrates they need for their performance for as many hours as they're going to compete. And if the gut is the rate limiting step, no matter how good those 90 grams per hour would have been, that they are not going to be able to have that. So you have to train for that as well.
From a practical perspective, here's how I've always approached it, and I'd like to hear how you've done it, like with athletes. The highest quality sessions, I make very little, if any, compromise on the fueling strategy. So they're going to go out and they're going to do like 4x8 minute tempo repeats or a set of, you know, high intensity, like VO2 max types of intervals and things like that. Like, I want the athlete well fed, feeding during the session if they need to. There's no consideration for compromising on the fueling or even the fluid and the electrolyte side of things. For the longer runs, and this is really important in an ultramarathon setting, they're the longer runs, the 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 hour runs and things like that are kind of like the bread and butter of an ultra runner's schedule, because not only does that prepare them cardiovascularly, but also from a musculoskeletal standpoint, that yeah. prepares the athlete. And then also, as you mentioned, from a gut training standpoint, that's where you get all of your the proof is in the pudding strategies on your nutritional plan to see if they are actually going to work during race day because the stress of the run is so high. On those runs, because they're so long and they're so hard, and it's a proof point for the nutrition strategy that you're ultimately going to use during the ultramarathon, I don't really make any compromises on the fuel there. It's like full race strategy, which is really not that high in an ultramarathon situation as compared to like a 4 hour road race or something like that, or even an Ironman triathlon where they're like a super steady, you know, rate the whole time. But anyway, yeah. the long, hard ones, I don't kind of make this low training availability strategy. I don't really throw it into consideration. But it's for like the shorter endurance runs, like the 2 hour endurance runs or the 2.5 hour endurance runs and things like that, that if there is any manipulation, and that's always an individual question, those are the ones that if the answer to that question is yes, yeah, we want to manipulate those things. Those are like the first candidates, because the athlete can complete the session with very little compromise, with lower carbohydrate availability, and they're not impacting the work that they're not actually impacting the work that they're doing. That's where I start from. And I honestly like to have it run into a lot of situations where I've had to really deviate away from that, because I've always viewed the work as more like you're going to get more benefit from having higher quality work than you are from manipulating the fuel and getting lower quality work and then having some sort of, you know, bounce from the low carbohydrate availability. So from a practical perspective, that's always I've always kind of cherry picked the sessions that are in some cases like the least meaningful to make those additional manipulations.
Yeah, I think that's a sensible approach. I think, you know, we have to, you know, while you were talking, I'm just thinking, okay, what, you know, just we always have to go back to whatever evidence we have to that one intervention is better than yeah. another one. And when we think about this whole carbohydrate periodization and so on, like, well, there are, you know, there is good evidence to show that, well, it actually changes the way your skeletal muscles respond to actual training and so on, but we are yet to see like a very clear performance benefit.
Right.
Yeah, so there's the thing is it's very, very hard to test the performance and the effect of these interventions on performance, because they require a lot of control and they require, you know, a lot of work. This whole idea of carbohydrate periodization, whether it's better than high carbohydrate or low carbohydrate, and probably the best studies on these when they're testing performance is like the what they are called the supernova studies by mm-hmm. Louise Berg, which are I think one of the first few studies who are like you know doing like longer term interventions where they see changes in substrate use with like different like low carbohydrate high fat interventions and you know different types of training in the different groups and yep. so on. They're like probably so far the best studies on trying to assess whether there is a performance benefit, and the way they test performance as well has like ecologic validity. So it's very much like they run the studies as if they were proper like races. Like,
yeah.
And we're talking like race walking here, yep. where these studies have been done. And these don't really show a more beneficial effect of carbohydrate periodization compared to a regular high carbohydrate diet. Yeah. So whether it's the way we're testing performance or the duration of the test or so on, we really have to, you know, try to, the science of it is a bit difficult in a way because it's hard to control.
Yeah. And what you're alluding to is how transient those adaptations are, because we know we can take on these low carbohydrate availability interventions and we can study the effects immediately after those interventions in the lab. And a lot of times the results of those are kind of like, it's, you know, excuse my French, but it's kind of like a no shit, you know, type of result. Yeah, you don't have, you're restricting carbohydrates, so they're going to upregulate their fat metabolism. But how long that sticks around for, how transient those metabolic adaptations are, and how they then manifest into performance adaptations, that's kind of like the gap that I think we're currently missing. And what and because we're missing that gap, what the result of that is on the practitioner side, on the coaching side, we're making logical extensions of the research to provide counsel to athletes on what they should actually be doing. That's really what we're doing. We're trying to interpret what the research says in a box and say, okay, from a practical perspective, here's how we're going to implement that. And that's where we start to see these like practitioner-based like nuances in the advice that's given out from one coach to another for, you know, what one athlete does versus another athlete does.
Yeah. Don't get me wrong. I'm not disregarding the importance of these sort of studies and, you know, this whole idea of, you know, potentially how good carbohydrate manipulation might be for adaptation. I think it's based on sound science, and, you know, there's a lot of research on it. I've contributed myself to it. I still have like ongoing work on this area, and I think it's great and very exciting. But my point is that we have to be sort of, approach it with care in terms of like the recommendations we give and how these might or not be backed up by evidence. Yep. I think that's the take home message. So if I was to say something in terms of what you should be doing and what you should not be doing in terms of like carbohydrate periodization and so on, is that, you know, at least ensure that for the hard long sessions you have the fuel you need, and for the rest of the sessions it depends on, you know, how you as an athlete can cope with it. But, you know, the fact that you're like training with low carbohydrate is not necessarily gonna be good all the time.
I think that's a brilliant place to leave it. Pick your big battles. Make sure that you're fueled for those, and then if there's an advanced intervention, consider trickling it in a little bit of a lower stakes situation.
Yeah.
Jose, before we break, first off, I really appreciate your time. Thanks for joining us all the way from the UK. Where can people learn a little bit more about you and some of the research that you do once you get back to doing more research, I guess?
we have a few things in the pipeline, and I try to share all the relevant information that I found about, you know, energy availability and energy balance and my main topics of research through Twitter. So I think that's probably the best way that I try to sort of share whatever expertise I have on whatever topics I work in. So my Twitter handle is at J L Areta. So I'm gonna spell that J for Jose, L for it's Lisandro is my second name, is L for Luis, and then Areta, Areta. So at J L Areta. That's my Twitter account. So just follow me there, and I'm sharing as much information as I can.
What's going to be the next thing to come out of your lab, or do you even know yet?
Well, what's going to come next? That's always up to the editors and reviewers. That is a battle that we constantly have as researchers. You know, it's just like Sometimes you think you're going at full speed until you get to the traffic lights, and sometimes that's well, I have like a few studies from my postdoc that I hope they're gonna be coming out soon. One of the ones that I did before being here in Liverpool, John Moores, that was in the Norwegian School of Sport Sciences in Oslo, and doing a postdoctoral research. And one of the last studies that I did there was on, you know, whether manipulating energy availability acutely via means of changing the amount of fat you have in your recovery meals, if that has an effect on the early adaptation. So that we hope that's going to be published sometime soon. It's been a long, windy road for that research, but we hope it's going to come out soon at one point. I think it's a really nice study. And we have, you know, ongoing work with professional cyclists that we hope we can publish sometime soon. We have a few things in the pipeline, yeah.
Awesome. Well, I can't wait for it to come out. Thanks again for your time. And
yeah, thank you for the invitation. It was great to chat.
Absolutely. This was brilliant. And there you have it. Thanks to Jose for coming on the podcast today. Really appreciate his insight into this area of low energy availability. Also appreciate all the listeners out there, each and every last one of you. If you are so inclined, go ahead and scroll on over to Apple Podcasts and give this podcast a rating or a review. It helps the podcast out a tremendous amount. Or you can just hit me up on social media and let me know what you thought of this podcast. Appreciate the heck out of each and every last one of you. We will see you next time and see you out on the trails.